Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. They also sponsor my new project with a platform called lovejoy.co.uk. This is a collection of articles and films and stuff and things that I've learned from doing the podcast, all the experts I speak to, and I thought, what can I do with it? Let's take it all, and I've put it all on a platform, and I'm making some original content for there too. It's not self-help, it's me questioning life. So hopefully building a community of people who like to question life, basically. And as you know, I have more questions than answers on all these things. I'd love to know what you think. Please go and have a look. Go to lovejoy.co.uk. Have a look. Let me know what you think. All feedback is good feedback. I don't mind, but I would like to know what you think about it and whether you think it's a useful tool or just an interesting platform to read. On today's hour, well, today I'm curious as to whether art is important. Help me out with this. I'm going to be having a conversation with Bob and Roberta Smith. Bob and Roberta Smith wrote a book called You Are an Artist, and it's had quite an impact on me and my daughter as we now spend time together creating art, and we both absolutely love it. It's one of the things we look forward to doing together. It had numerous ideas in it, but I think the thing which hit home with me most was the idea, it really resonated with me, the idea that I didn't have to keep my art, that I could just bin it, or I could just leave it somewhere. I didn't have to keep coming back to it. It didn't have to define me. And this is really deep stuff, but I've always sat down with a pen and paper or some paints looking at it going, what am I going to do to create? And I think in the back of my mind, it was always going to be forever. And I was like, hold on, it doesn't have, an idea is not forever. Art doesn't have to be forever, you know? So just that slight shift in when I was reading through his book and stuff made me think, I can just do this. I can do something and it can be awful and it doesn't have to define me at all. It's just an awful thing I've done, which started off as a good idea but ended up being bad. Actually, though, some of the stuff I do is quite good. I'm quite proud of myself. Anyway, Bob and Roberta Smith is a contemporary artist, activist, writer, broadcaster, musician, art education advocate, and a keynote speaker. Bob also made a great documentary about protesting for the BBC. Very, very good. Hopefully we'll get on to talk about that a bit later. That made me think a lot. He's here now. Hi, Bob. How are you?
I'm great. Yeah, very nice to talk to you, Tim. Yeah, very interesting.
Let's start with what I was just talking about there, which is the fact that... you know, art, we get taught bad things about art, don't we, when we're kids, and I've been scared of art, and I've really gone nowhere near any art since school, and you know, I'm in my 50s now, and you came on Sunday brunch, I read your book, and I thought, there's some great ideas in this, I'm going to start doing my daughter. Literally, your book has changed my life, because I sit down with my daughter, we do it at least once a week, and we just get anything, like sometimes pencils, sometimes paint, sometimes we do collages. We just come up with an idea, sometimes we do a slogan, and we just come up with ideas and try and work it out, you know. Why is it that art is just seen as something you do at school, I suppose?
I think it's an interesting question, really. I think it might be good to think about what the nature of that question is, really. If you had asked that to somebody before the invention of photography, they would have been bemused, because they would have said, well, artists are the only people who can make images. So if you'd said to Piero della Francesca or Michelangelo, you know, what are you doing? What's it all about? They would have said, well, I'm making these images. And actually a lot of that has to do with portraiture. And then, so some people could do really good portraits, some people weren't quite so hot. So then you get hierarchies of different artists, but they're all making images. And then the camera comes along. And of course now, anybody can make really amazing images. And you've even got apps, so you can make it look like, you make it look like a Toulouse-Lautrec, or you can make it look like a Vincent van Gogh or something. So, but certainly in the 20th century, and I think in the 50s and 60s, you know, the media, they come along with saying, well, you know, looking at Picasso and saying, well, a child of six could do that, you know, or all that sort of thing. But I think that's also to do with art slightly, because the camera came along, art slightly had to look underneath the bonnet, if you like, and kind of an artist started looking at the engine of art rather than looking at quite where they were going, and thought, well, there are interesting things here, you know, and that's where abstraction comes from. So people were actually looking at what we call formal things, you know, actually how it's put together. So then art became about that. And then, of course, you had people who had to interpret that. Lots of wealthy people buying art. They need to be told why they've got to spend all the money on art. And so it becomes, so then actually in the modern age, it becomes quite, you know, it does become quite an elitist thing. And so you have to sort of acknowledge that if you're an artist. But what's exciting now is that art is becoming much more about storytelling. And you kind of see with artists like Yuki Shonabari and Carla Walker, post Black Lives Matter and all that sort of thing, that art actually is gaining a new kind of very much more obvious and explainable kind of importance, in that it's about showing the world that we live in and the times that we live in, and telling perhaps personal stories about it, like Tracy Emin does. But it's also about understanding other people's lives. So it's kind of, I think it's gaining a new, I think we're entering a new era for art, really, in an interesting way, where that kind of question, like, why are you doing it, is going to sort of become a bit more easy to answer, rather than saying, you know, why are you making a very abstract and conceptual, you know, kind of complicated thing that only a few people understand. I think art's going to become much more popular again. And actually, Tim, that's just that is the sort of subject of my you know, the follow-up book, or the thing that it's extremely early stage at the moment, but I'm kind of working on a new idea for a book which will kind of address that question, you know, like why. What's the importance of art? You know, I mean, I think we think about the importance of art might be selling art to very wealthy people, and it maybe that's part of it. But it, I want to try and explore that idea. You know, and it's going to take me about a year or 6 months to do it. So I'm on a journey with you on that one, Tim, I think.
Yeah, well, I think we'll get onto that question in a minute. What do you make of the fact that you wrote a book, you're an artist, for some reason, I'm not sure why, you end up on Sunday Brunch, I get this book in my hand, and now it's sort of changed the relationship I have with art and my daughter. That must feel like mission accomplished.
I tell you, it's been a good thing to do. I think the publisher came to me and said, I mean, I've written, I don't know, three or four books about art. Some of them have been just been about what I do. But of course, art books, selling art books, they're quite often things we call monograph. You know. Oh, that's the cat attacking some food there. But they're quite often, you know, like just about a particular artist, or they're about a particular historical idea. But they, you know, they don't sell to a mass market. You know, they sell to fans of that artist and to art students and aficionados. So the challenge is always to make a book where you can kind of reach across that gap and reach a new audience. And that was sort of the challenge, because I think they knew I was quite a, you know, garrulous person, quite interested in doing that. And also a lot of my activity in the last few years has been about advocating the arts to government, really, and stop trying to say why they shouldn't cut money to arts, or arts in schools particularly. And so in a way, the book was a roundabout way of putting that down. But then I just thought, well, let's just really go for it. Let's just try and give people things to do, and make a book which was like a cookery book. So I wanted it to be like a cookery book. And then, of course, you know, and the nice thing about what you're saying is that you know, like it might seem a bit throwaway, you know, you can make something and then not worry about it too much. And actually, that's a really interesting point. It's something that I hadn't really considered that much. But the thing about, if, of course, if you're an artist, you know, you go to galleries and look at music, go to museums and see art and stuff. So you see the art that's being produced by other people. But if you're an artist, you're making things all the time. You're not really, you're not aiming to make this specific thing. What you're doing is going on a journey, and hopefully what you come up with at the end of it is really exciting, and it takes you somewhere. I think that's the thing, that's the motivation for art. And I think that's something you probably discovered with your daughter. On some funny level, it doesn't really matter what it looks like.
No, that's the thing. There's more to art. We create art together, and we'll do something like, what did we do the other day? We did cartoon characters. We've done slogans. We did a product, and we've got to design the logo for a product. We just invent stuff, all basically because we got inspired by the
idea that you did. Can I catch that? I'm going to write, jot down some of those ideas.
So I'm just always coming up with these little ideas, and we're now doing it, but based on stuff from your book. And then what we do, what's lovely, is we're looking at each other's art all the time, and she's going, oh, I really like the way you've done that. And I'm saying to her, I love the colours you're using. And she says, which colour shall I use? I don't know. You decide. And then she does it, and I go, I love the way you're doing that. And it's this real positive affirmation for each other that we're doing something. And it's, you don't really, when I play a lot of games with her, we're playing against each other. This, we're playing with each other, because we're sort of saying we're both supporting each other in creating art. It's a really amazing hour we will spend, and they only take an hour. And then I've got a lot of them downstairs, but they're just disposable. We don't really care about them. When they're finished, they're finished. We put them away, then we start a new one, and that's the beauty of it. Well, we're not thinking, let's frame them and sell them.
That is really interesting to me, because that's doing what artists hope their art will do, is that it's creating a feedback loop. That's the thing that in the first part of the book I talk about doing exactly that with my daughter, and her drawing a giraffe, and then her saying, well, the giraffe, you know, didn't look anything like a giraffe, you know, it was just just like a circles and squares and things, and then she said, that's a giraffe. And of course she's making a link between giraffes, her drawing, her capacity to do it, and having a conversation with me, and that's called joint attention. It's a psychological thing. Psychologists have named that joint attention. So that what you and your daughter, you're constructing an image of the world, and you're talking about it, and that's a feedback loop. So you're making that loop, and that's really on some basic level, that's what it's all about. You know, artists aren't really, I mean, some artists are, but artists aren't really about sort of making things and they go out into the world and they're just there and people have to, you know, kind of worship the fantastic artist who made it. Really, what you want is a kind of conversation, and actually that comes into ideas about protest and all of that. But actually it can be like making a cartoon character, or can be about making, you know, if your child does a drawing of a plant or something, or looks at something and inspects the world and sees what's out there, looking out the window, and they make a drawing, and then you're then having this conversation about it. Joining up that feedback loop, and that's very satisfying. That and also that is changing the world in a weird way. People who can't close that loop or can't create those kind of feedback loops, that becomes very frustrating for them, and that's where you get kind of anger and shoutiness and violence and all of that, because it's also one of the things that happens with social media. You know, people want attention, you know, we love attention, and so that's why people jump into these. I mean, I heard your podcast with John Ronson, and one of the things is that you know, politicians create pretexts for other people to start shouting at each other, and that creates, you know, it gives them sort of power, and that's in a weird way, that's them getting hold of the feedback loop. So it, there's lots of psychological things going on in these, in that kind of exercise you're doing with your daughter. But the thing about it in the end is that it's about you spending time with your daughter, you're making something that's positive, and you're having a conversation, you know. You're not just taking her to the movies and say, hey, have a look at this and have some popcorn, you know. It's a real moment, you know.
Yeah, and interestingly, you say we're taking it out of schools. I don't know what's happening with that, actually. I'm not aware of that. But all the points you make there are really important. I was watching the Brits last night, and the bit I turned on was Little Sims talking about, she said she's an artist, she's from a council estate, and she's, you know, she can do it, she's worked hard. And it's like, that's what we want, isn't it? We want ideas, and we want people to have voices and ideas. And one of the questions I was going to say to you is, you know, how important is art? And I think art is so important. I've said this for a long time, because a lyric, maybe a picture, a slogan, a poem, something out there would make an impact on me much more than a sort of a catchphrase from a politician or someone with a loud hailer. And I think that's important, especially when it comes to things like music. You know, the stuff the Beatles did and John Lennon, and I'm a massive fan of the Specials, the lyrics from their songs about, you know, black and white youths together, or all youths together. Very important. And it was very important. And that's the way they can talk to us. And it's a much nicer way to talk to us. Just a great example of this, actually, is when Specials turned into the latter stage of the Specials, and Jerry Dammers did Free Nelson Mandela, a song with a catchy chorus, which a lot of people have said helped get Nelson Mandela freed from prison in South Africa. A song which helps do that is absolutely amazing. The amount of politicians and people who were, you know, who shouted about it, who wrote columns about it, and then a song comes along and it has all that power. I mean, there was more to it than just a song, but the song really put Nelson Mandela on the map, that people start going, hold on, how long has he been in prison? What did he do? You know, it's that sort of thing. So art is important in that way, isn't it?
Oh, God. Well, it's very interesting. I mean, I think I'm probably a little bit older than you, but certainly the music of that era was really powerful, and I was totally it's one of the fundamental moments in my life, going to the second anti-racist march, and then going to Nelson Mandela's birthday and hearing Special AKA play that song on his 70th birthday on the stage at Hyde Park, and Jerry Dammers and the Specials, they did this brilliant thing, which was just just that slogan, black and white, unite and fight, that allowed white kids who were I just went to a comprehensive school, everybody was there, you know, black, white, Asian kids, Indian kids, we were all at this school. When I went to university, it was only the white kids at the university. So my experience of being at school, going to gigs, but buying those records, that was so powerful. And also the great thing was that it was quite a commercial thing. You know, you were buying Ghost Town as a single, but what you would do, they were sort of selling a kind of a very positive political ideal, but they didn't get an Arts Council grant to do it. Do you know what I mean? They were quite entrepreneurial, and that I just thought, I think the whole marriage of all of that, you know, I just thought Two Tone Records was just a fantastic thing. It's great that you brought that up, because it's one of the things that I really chew over a lot. I'm very, very influenced by the art exhibitions that I've been to see over the years, you know, and I think of all the, you know, the great exhibitions that I've been to see. But my God, the gigs that I've seen, they have, you know, I want to make a painting that's as exciting as seeing James Brown in in Rome when I saw him. You know, it was such an energetic gig. And so I've been making these paintings recently, which have been about remembered gigs. And I've done, I want there to be about 7 or 8 of them at the moment, like really key gigs that I just passionately love. Like you might love, I mean, one of the things I like about the Sunday brunch is that it's about food. And I quite often think, I want to make a painting that I really love as much as I like eggs and bacon, you know, or I like listening to the Jam. And so I've made these paintings. One is of the Jam playing Going Underground at the Rainbow. Another is seeing the Fall playing City Hobgoblins in Reading Top Rank. And then the one I'm working on the moment is seeing the Specials much more recently at Margate Dreamland. And I'm trying to make a painting. It's funny because they're not paint. The song that really stood out for me in that gig was The Lunatics Have Taken Over the Asylum, which is actually a Funboy Freeze.
Yeah. Yeah, they started playing that, haven't they, in their modern set? Yeah.
Yeah, but when they play it, it's like a Bertolt Brecht song. It's like Kurt Vile or something, you know. It's just so, and also so, I mean, it's always timely, that song, I think, since they put it out. But it's just such a, and so I'm trying to make paintings of these. It's an impossible thing to do. How can you, you know, in one of the bits in the You Are an Artist book, I talk about how impossible it is to paint the sunset. You know, because actually you can't paint the, like an image. You can make an image out of bits of paint and canvas and stuff, which you can say is a sunset, but it's not a sunset. You know, a sunset is like a nuclear explosion going off 93 million miles away. You know, you can't do that. So it's kind of like I'm trying to paint these memories of these great kind of cultural moments. I'm trying to say all of this stuff, you know, like food and music and culture. It's all the same, you know, it's inspiring. That's the thing. That's the thing. You know, if you're sort of arrogant enough or kind of pompous enough to call yourself an artist, in a way, your mission is to try and inspire others. And my God, you know, the Specials really did that. They totally inspired a generation. It's one of the slightly frustrating things, but quite funny moments in the film that I made for BBC Four, when I talked to Billy Bragg, you know, and Billy Bragg was at the other gig, you know, which is the more famous one where he saw The Clash and X-Ray Specs. And he thought, you know, on interview saying, well, you know, I thought I could do that, you know. So that inspired him to be Billy Bragg, really.
If you watch Bob's documentary
on the show, it's like, no, art doesn't change the world, mate. I've tried.
Yeah, but I disagree. Just needs catchier tunes. That's what. That's what he needs. Let's talk a bit about you, Bob. As I understand it, your parents were artists, your wife's an artist, your son's an artist, your children are artists. You're a family of artists, but how did you, when is it that you start going, I'm actually, this is my job, this is what I'm putting down on my passport, this is my career? How does that happen? I know you're exhibiting artwork at the moment, but tell us how it works that you actually can go, I'm an artist.
Well, I think it is, obviously it's a kind of really peculiar thing to declare yourself, but I think, you know, there are lots of stock answers to that, but the thing about, I think, doing these kind of interviews is to think fresh about it all, really. I mean, I think lots of things about it. I think one of the things that really, you know, I like I understood art in a totally different way to most people, I think, growing up. I mean, my parents, they, all the food on our table was because they were artists, you know. It wasn't like a kind of nice thing to have or a pleasure or an indulgence. It was quite hard work, and they would be selling paintings and they were teaching a bit. My dad was ended up running Chelsea School of Art in the 60s, which was an interesting time, you know. But for them, I mean, one of the things that's really been a powerful powerhouse in my thinking is that because they were good at art, it completely revolutionized our lives. And my dad started life on the Fulham Road making margarine, and my grandfather used to sell vegetables on the Fulham Road, and my mother's father, he was a plumber in Margate, and it's kind of strange that they both had these children it was to do with skills. They were good at drawing, and because they were good at drawing, they went then to art school, and they were kind of taken up and given a training, and it meant that they they could earn money making art. So I always felt that art was quite an important thing, central to people's lives. Never quite understood why people weren't into it. and I still sort of think that. I mean, I think, you know, a pencil is quite a cheap thing, and a bit of paper, you know, you can kind of, you know, you could, anybody can make a drawing. And actually, artists are only people who call themselves artists. Anybody can make art, you know. But I suppose the question is then about being, you know, a professional artist, and how that works. And I suppose the moment where I did have a bit of a kind of moment, because like all kids, I wanted to rebel. So I wanted to rebel against my teenage years. I wanted to rebel against my my artistic parents, and so I wanted to, you know, I wanted to be a vet for a while, and all that sort of thing, you know, childhood roles that you see on television. I think it was to do with James Herriot on the TV, and but then there was a big moment where I was in as a comprehensive, you know, just I was invited to go to the Whitechapel Art Gallery. Or there was a leaflet that the art teacher had got, I think, to go to the Whitechapel Art Gallery to see an exhibition by Max Beckmann, and who was a German expressionist painter, that kind of Weimar period. He kind of made paintings which were a bit like the Footney Opera, or a bit like Mack the Knife or something. His paintings were like visual manifestations of that, in a way, echoes of that in things like, you know, seeing the specials, in a way, kind of politics and art all jamming together. And I just found it so exciting and dynamic. And then they said, so they told us all about Max Beckmann, and they took us up to this enormous studio. There were only four or five of us, I think, signed up for this thing, you know, from all the classes across London. And they just gave us enormous sheets of paper and paint. And they just said, here you go, forget about the Max Beckmanns downstairs, just make something big. And actually my parents' art was all quite hard work. It was about tying yourself to a hillside or or going out into a landscape and carefully painting it. But this was like play. And it was, and I suddenly thought, oh, this is much more fun. I can do this, you know. I think it was that thing like you're identifying with your daughter. They were like, well, don't bother about what it looks like. Don't try and make it look like a Max Beckmann. You know, there's no point in doing that. Max Beckmann's already done it. What are you going to do? And so it was kind of, it was a really powerful moment that. And I thought, and it came at that time, you know, 16, 17, and I just thought, oh, I do want to go to art school after all. So then I went to art school.
Good.
And then it's about always trying to be, you know, better than everybody else in your year.
And the first time you sell a piece of art, is that an amazing experience that somebody else wants to buy into your visions?
Well, that's it's hard work selling art. It's an interesting thing. It's great, you know, when somebody buys. I mean, I encourage everybody to make things, to try and make things to sell, but then also to buy other people's art. And it's great. It's an amazing thing when somebody says, well, actually, I want that, you know. And I always think that's really exciting. It's part of...
The first time...
Yeah, no, go ahead.
The first time I bought art was I bought a Victor Vassarelli. I was drunk and I had a friend and he was an art dealer.
Oh, great.
And he said, come back. Well, I'd only met him recently back when it was. And he said, come, and I was drunk and he went and I looked at it and I loved the frame because it was an old sort of 60s glass frame, plastic perspex, which went around the side of it. And he said, that's a Victor Vassarelli print. And I said, okay, blah, blah, blah. And I bought it and it was quite expensive. And I was sort of on TV at the time, so I had a bit of cash. Didn't have any kids in those days. And I remember waking up the next day and it was there in my house. And I remember looking at it going, I've just spent money on something which doesn't do anything. And then panicking about it for a long time. And then I eventually put it up on the wall and people come in and go, I like that. And I'd like, I own something which doesn't do anything. It's really nice. And there's a history behind it. And it's, you know, someone who's a proper artist. And I just sort of fell in love with it. And
well, Vincent Vassarelli, it's interesting because people who don't know his work, but he's a kind of French op artist, isn't he? It's kind of abstract, abstract stuff, a bit like Bridget Riley or something like that, but quite closely painted, isn't it?
This was one of his early works, and it was black and white, and they were quite. It wasn't quite as detailed as he ended up doing, so it was like early work. So I now feel even better. I knew the specials before they were the specials type thing. Do you know what I mean? and now it's like I've got Victor Vassarelli before he was Victor Vassarelli. It's like
discerning eye, discerning ear, Tim.
Well, the last thing, the one bit of art I bought, which I was too scared to pick up, again, it was during I'd had some drinks and I was at an auction and I bought this piece of work from an artist called Scooney, who's a friend of mine now, and I love it. And it's a model. It's like, I'll have to send you a picture of it. It's a model of a little boy who's holding a grenade. And it's, you know, it's quite strange because it's life-size model, like
sounds slightly in, like might be in the Banksy mode.
Yes, but it's like a mannequin, and it's fantastic, and I love it. And people come into my, and it's the most beautiful piece of art ever because it's a boy holding a grenade. He does a lot, and I've got a picture of his as well. A small boy wearing a helmet with a nuclear explosion going off in the glasses. It talks about children and war and stuff like that. So it's got a story, as you say. That's the point. And I love it. But the impact this thing has, because I've got it in a glass frame. I used to have it out and kids used to keep coming and touching it because they wanted to touch it. And I was like, it was great. But I was like, hold on, that cost me a few quid. So I put it in the thing and people come in and they go, what the hell is that? And I think, and I love it because some people go, I love it. And some people go, it creeps me out. I hate it. I'm like, that's what good art is. It has an impact, whether it's good or bad, it has an impact.
Yeah, it's a kind of provocation, isn't it? Well, it's brilliant that you're buying things. I mean, one of my hobby horses is at the moment is trying to get kids in school to make art and then to sell it to their parents to raise money for good causes. So I've got this hashtag,
brilliant,
Help Art Save Lives. And I'm hoping, you know, there's never been an art aid. There's been, you know, there's kind of Macmillan coffee mornings and there's Live Aid and Do Something Funny for Money and Sport Aid and all of that. But there's never been art aid. But artists are asked constantly to donate pieces of work to for charity, you know, and they have these kind of you know, swanky events and cocktails and champagne and stuff. But actually, you can sell art if you know, like if your daughter did a, you know, you did a lovely drawing with your daughter, you know, you could, you know, you could sell it to Simon or prompt yeah. Simon to give the money to a charity. And that's actually available to everybody to do that. So that's one
that's
of the things.
That,
so I'm trying to. Well, it's a bit grassrootsy at the moment. I have talked to you know, to big organisation, you know, media organisations to try and get it going. We're trying to gently push that forward, but in a grassrootsy kind of way. I'm trying to get this idea that Help Art Save. I sold a little A5 thing this morning for a £200 donation to the DEC appeal for Afghanistan, and it's, you know, it's kind of, it's interesting, you know, you could, any artist can do this, you know. I really encourage people to do it. Just put something up on Instagram and say, look, if you give a, you know, a donation to a, you know, a life-saving charity like Save the Children or whatever it is, I will send you this drawing. And again, you know, selling something is that thing we were talking about a little bit earlier. It's the feedback loop. It's somebody getting the attention and sending it off and people loving it. And also it creates conversation, doesn't it? Like your friends coming in saying, oh, I hate that or I love that. You know, it's a provocation. It's prompting further discussion, isn't it?
The other thing about art as well is when I do art with my daughter, it's like a mindfulness thing that everyone discusses. You end up going into, I sound so deep, but you do end up going into your painting and you spend time. When you do it on our show, you see I completely lose contact with the idea that I'm talking to
it's
you.
Funny. And
I
just, there's silence on our show.
I just concentrate.
There was silence. It was like, oh.
There was, because it's, but people like watching that sort of stuff. My friend's an illustrator and she goes in and she teaches children with troubled backgrounds and things. I won't go into too much detail, but she goes in and she just tries to get them to express themselves through art. Some struggle a lot with it because it's their lives are too raw. But she says her biggest problem is telling the parents of these children to whatever they put on the papers is acceptable. You have to train the parents to say it doesn't matter what they're doing. They're just expressing themselves. And that's the beauty of art. But she says it helps them so much because it calms children down who have gone through, you know, emotional things. And art is a beautiful way of just trying to get children to express themselves and I mean, yeah, just be creative and come alive. And so she's doing a great job on that. Can I just play art critic for 1 minute?
Yeah.
Not critic. What's the word? I'm going to try and talk to you a bit. Yeah, I'm going to talk to you a bit about how I perceive some of your work. So, so you do a lot of signs, and as one of your styles. And what I thought was amazing about that is, with the modern world, words are becoming, just since the, you know, evolution of print, but even more so with the internet and social media, words are becoming so valuable, but they're also sort of, well, they're losing their meaning a bit as well. But it's a powerful thing. Word, I tell you what, that is, words are irresistible, aren't they? You can't, like, if you're watching any of the things which are happening at the moment, Boris or footballers doing whatever, or you know, celebrities saying whatever, everything else, there's all these issues going on at the moment. It's the words coming at you, and we can't help. Now we all know how to read. You know, obviously conversation's a good thing. Those words are absolutely irresistible, and it seems to me that is what you're creating, a very modern thing, which is an irresistible look at words. Am I correct in my, have I insulted you?
No, I think that, no, you've got to the heart of it, really. I mean, in the You Are an Artist book, I tried not to, I didn't really linger on my own preoccupations too much. But you're absolutely right. The idea of the word. I mean, one of my thoughts about words is that they're kind of innocent, really. They don't really mean what they say. And I've worked with slogans for 20, 30 years, and it's the difference between lots of things interest me about it, about painting words, but it's the difference between how things look and what they mean, what words sound like, and also inspecting, all of these slogans which are fired at you. And of course, as we've moved into this era, with Twitter and social media, where you can write something quite quickly and stick it out there without too much thought to gain attention, we do that using words. The 140 characters or whatever it used to be on Twitter, it's a kind of poetic form, but by painting a word and thinking about the word, you're really sort of dealing with something quite abstract, really. In a way I'm being the thing that I was criticizing earlier, looking underneath the bonnet of something every day to try and see what's really there. But poets obviously do this. You're looking at the specifics, the meter, the pentameter, the flavor of the word, how it comes off the tongue, how the mouth forms it, and all of that interests me. If you can paint. And one of the things that's been interesting me more and more is, when you see a sign in the street that says, go left or keep off the grass or something, it's painted with authority. And so a lot of my sign writing has been about kind of aping that sense of, the authority by which something might be conveyed, very bold lettering on a green background or a red or yellow background, but making it a bit wobbly. So perhaps the authority is not quite there. So there's an aspect of it where somehow I'm getting at my, when I'm painting and actually what I'm doing when I'm making those pieces is that I'm improvising the colours. I'm kind of making it up as I go along, which no graphic designer would do. And you wouldn't get a job if you did graphic design quite like that. So what I'm doing is trying to insert a bit of human frailty into the whole business of how we communicate and trying to put a bit of humanity into it, really, I suppose.
I absolutely love it. I love the stuff you do.
One of the things that's really heartening for me is when, and this is something that's only really happened in the last few years, where teachers, they teach kids art, and quite often they do it using contemporary artists, and sometimes they use me, and they get their kids to. But the great thing about using Bob and Roberta Smith in that way is that they don't say to the kids, paint, make art, not war, because that's too didactic. They say, well, what would you say? What's the slogan that you would choose? And then what colours would you choose? So they make all these hybrids of those slogans, which are completely their own. And the kids in the class come up with 36 different slogans. Half of them are better than mine. And I find that really exciting, that they're kind of improvising their own language and coming up with their own poetic ideas or political ideas. And also the arts in schools, the arts in schools is the one place really where the teacher has not got the right answers. It's the kids that have got the right answers,
That's definitely.
And the kids coming up with all these different versions of Bob and Roberta Smith actually, that is really interesting. They're going back to one of my very early slogans, was that they're really making their own damn art, you know. Not expecting me.
Yeah, that interesting, and making art accessible. By the way, just quickly, I want to get into art accessible in language. I do think a lot about language. The word love is just it's been so bastardized and so used for abuse and everything else. When anyone uses words like that, I always say is that if someone says, "Oh, I love pancakes," I say define love, because you can't have one word which is meant, you know, "Oh, sorry, I had an affair, but I really love you." And I noticed it. I was on this podcast, we did a trilogy of people who had affairs. Turns out if you're gonna have an affair, it's horrific, a lot of admin, and nobody ends up happy. So we did one version where the man had an affair. These are all true stories, by the way. And then the next podcast was someone where a woman had been had an affair, or the woman had had the affair, and then the third one was the person who was in the middle with the affair happening around them. All of them, it all always backfires. It was always horrible, but every one of the story, it would always go, "But I loved them. But I loved. They said they loved me. But I love." And I just thought that word is just used constantly with for bullshit reasons in shitty relationships and shitty jobs and shitty everything. And it's just, it doesn't mean anything. You're much better to turn around to your wife or your husband or your boyfriend or your girlfriend, your partner, and say, "You matter to me," because matter is a much more powerful word than love can be these days. Because people love, I don't know, snooker. They love whatever. I love my new slippers. It's, you know, they don't say snooker matters to me. My slippers matter to me. And I think mattering is a more powerful word. I don't know why, but I want to have that everywhere, you know.
Yeah, I'm going to paint matter.
But making it accessible. I went to an Anthony Gormley talk once. I'm interested in hearing people talk about these things. And he said he was in an art gallery. I love this bit, actually. He said, "I was in an art gallery and looking at doing my work, you know, exhibiting my work. And I looked through the window and I saw these people walking out. And I thought, why am I going to put my painting in here where people have to, pay lots of money to get in and stuff, when I could have my work out there and everyone could see it?" And so he started doing things like Angel of the North and all those sort of lovely things that he does. But he wants them on the street. And he goes, I think he said something, I'm making these words up, by the way, because it's a long time ago. But I think he said something like, "Whether you like my art or you don't, I want you to have to experience it." And I thought there was a situation where art galleries became a bit too poncy, didn't they? People didn't really want to go, and there was a bit too much to go into them. And art is becoming more accessible now, don't you think? There's more free galleries, there's more places to go and look at art, and it seems to be moving back to where it should be. It was, I think, because he was sort of talking about the last century was where it was just owned by the rich people, and now it seems to be moving back more towards, with the help of Banksy and people like you and stuff, it's moving back to more towards where it should be, right? Am I right?
Well, I think art definitely happens in your head, actually. You know, like, right, with your daughter, that's an art experience, isn't it? And it's a very genuine one, and probably as powerful as, you know, seen in Anthony Gormley or something. Do you know what I mean? It's actually a real thing, a real experience. And but I think you're right in that respect. So certainly art galleries have worked very hard, and actually they've realised that they've got to change, because from what you're saying, you know, you know, they can be kind of frightening and elitist places to go into, but they are now taking a bit more. I think they've still got ways to go, actually, but to be places where you can go and think of them like walking into a newspaper, or they're like a publisher's, or like or books, or somebody, or like they should be like going into somebody's front room. But they're a really interesting person. They've got some really interesting things to tell you, or show you, or experiences for you to have. And I think they're beginning to change in that way. I mean, Tate Modern has, you know, this is so tricky for them, because after the pandemic, I think they're going to be really important in building people's sense of, you know, the city centres of all of our cities, and bringing people back to the city centre. But Tate Modern, before the lockdown, had 4 million visitors a year.
Wow.
You know, and that's amazing. You know, and so I mean, this is outrageously trying to promote myself to you, but but on the fourth floor of Tate Modern at the moment, I've got this piece called the Thamesmead Codex, and what it is interviewing all these people who live on a housing estate, the famous Thamesmead or infamous Thamesmead housing estate, where they filmed a bit of The Clockwork Orange. You know, Kubrick's Clockwork Orange was filmed there, and I just interviewed people, and actually that piece is a bit of a Trojan horse, you know, because the voices in my Thamesmead Codex are not really the voices of art. They're the voice of artists. They're the voices of the audience, if you like. So it's trying to insert, I think, and I think the Tate's decision to get me to go to Thamesmead during, because it was initiated by them in relationship with Peabody, the housing trust, that was an attempt during COVID to say the museum needs to be outside and perhaps take on board something, you know, like Anthony Gormley's idea about public sculpture. You can understand that, you know, he's going to make sculpture outside that people can see and witness. But it's also trying to outreach to schools, to locations, to different kinds of audiences, and to say art is at your fingertips. You know, it's not so, you know, in a way, you know, art, you know, is something that you can access by just picking up a pencil, and the museum, in a way, you don't necessarily have to make that journey to the museum, although it's good to do that. In a way, that's the kind of headquarters of art, but art happens, as you say, in your head, in your conversation with your daughter, when you pick up a pencil. You know, that's where art's happening.
It's interesting, though, where we're going, because you talk about sculptures there with Anthony Gormley. David Shrigley's are constantly on Instagram producing art. I mean, this guy's insatiable. I don't know how many. It's like daily that guy's throwing up paintings and putting them on Instagram.
I know David. I mean, I met him a few times. I don't know him terribly well, but he's great. And he's got a great graphic sensibility, hasn't he?
It's amazing because he's making really poignant points about the world we're living in now and through art. So it's fantastic, and they're being shared a lot. But I'm trying to, so I always say to comedians, what's the point about you being online? You're giving away all your material if you're doing funny stuff on Instagram and Twitter and wherever else. And I'm thinking, you know, I mean, I know Shrigley sells lots of postcards and stuff like that, but he's doing a lot of art. So he's clearly thinking, this is where my domain is now. I'm doing it and I'm throwing it on social media and it's being shared. So he's doing the modern day Anthony Gormley, saying everyone's got to witness my art, whether you like it or not. This is going to be shared, and it's going to be shared big time. It's kind of intriguing, isn't it? And he did this one the other day because he's... I can't remember where, I wish I'd paid more attention, but people critique his, they go, your drawings are shit. And it's like completely missing the point of what he does. Yeah. It's brilliant. And he shared some of the feedback that he gets off people, which really made me laugh.
They are sort of shit.
that's the idea.
But they're kind of witty and shitty, aren't they?
That's the idea, yeah.
Through COVID, a lot of artists have gone online, so you can follow Tracy Emin or Damien Hirst, and you know, and actually it's interesting that they've chosen to do that, because in the past, to be cool as an artist was not to say anything very much, to be a bit like Kate Moss, to keep stum and let your art do the talking. But of course, when you can't go and see the art in any art galleries, there's no point in being quiet, just nobody knows you're out there. So suddenly, they're all on Instagram and stuff, including myself, you know.
The thing is, yeah, but you do lots of varying things on Instagram. So, you know, there are various different things. I do follow you. I follow Damien Hirst, and it's fascinating because I'm a big fan of him and his work. But when he lines up 30 canvases and does the same thing to them, I'm like, hold on a second. You know, there's a lot of, it doesn't feel like a Van Gogh or a Picasso or something where it's like, I'm putting all this effort into one. He's just got them all lined up and he's doing this. It's like a factory. And you're like, this doesn't feel unique to me. So you're seeing sort of behind the curtain a bit, and I'm not sure I want to see behind the curtain.
Yeah, it might not be good in the long run. But he said, I just did a show in a museum in the Voorlinden Museum, and they had a huge one of the paintings that he was doing of springtime.
And, yeah, they're brilliant.
And I'd seen him painting those on Instagram about a year ago.
Yeah.
And I, like you, I thought, okay. But actually, when I saw it, I thought it was quite good.
Yeah. Where did you say the exhibition was?
They paid for my piece.
Where did you say the exhibition was?
I sort of thought, oh, good on you. This is an exhibition. It's called Art is the Antidote, which is in this museum called the Voorlinden Museum, which is an amazing museum. Very easy to get to on Eurostar. You just go to Rotterdam, and now you can go direct to Rotterdam, and you can go to this museum. It's wonderful. And they have one of these enormous Damien Hirst. And I was kind of like... But actually, one of the things about Damien Hirst, he raised a lot of money for the NHS doing his kind of rainbow version of his butterflies. And I kind of thought, oh, actually, it's quite good what you're doing, mate.
Yeah, well, I think with all art, like whoever it is, whether it be, you know, Banksy or Van Gogh or whatever, it's people are talking about it and it creates a reaction and emotion in you. I can't get you up. We're running out of time here, but we can't get you on without talking. Damien Hirst recently sort of sold prints of one of his pictures, paintings. I can't remember which one now, but he said you can either have it as actual tangible print, or you can have it as an NFT. And apparently more people went for the NFT, non-fungible, what are they called? Non-fungible
asset or trademark.
Yeah.
And it really is tradable, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think the popular vote for the people buying it went for the NFTs, and it seems, and I think Damien Hirst actually said, I think I'm going to move into this direction. What is your view on that? Because I'm still struggling with the idea of buying something that I mean I own a couple actually, because I just was fascinated by it. They're only cheap, but I'm, you know, by just showing it on my phone, I can then take a screen grab of it and send it to my mate. They sort of own it because it only exists on my phone or my computer, whereas my Victor Vassarelli print, actually I can see it, I actually own it. It's like something tangible there. What so I can't get my head around it at the moment. What have you got any thoughts on this?
I'm definitely not an early adopter of the NFT, if I can say that, slightly, because I think it's so murky, its relationship with everything to do with Bitcoin, and you know, I think currencies need to be accountable, and so I'm not really going to go down the NFT route for myself. But I can see that Damien loves you know, he loves you know, provocation and all of that, and also it doesn't matter to him, you know, he can make a lot of money or no money on his NFTs. I'm sure it'll be very successful. Anybody can make money out of it. He can. But he's got so much money.
Talking about so much money.
Make his life any better.
Talking about so much money, I didn't realise that Van Gogh, I went to the Van Gogh exhibition actually, and I said, how do you say his name? And the guy went... some people say Van Gogh, some people say Van Gogh, but we say Van Gogh. I was like, really? I don't know what that means. But anyway, he did only sold one painting, didn't he? In his entire life, he just gave the rest away for coffee and sandwiches and stuff. And so, yeah, it's kind of a...
But I think the thing about Van Gogh, though, and actually this is what the heartening thing about Van Gogh, if you go and look at the sunflowers, or you go and look at the self-portraits in the National Gallery, or you, you know, or you get, or go off to Holland and go and see the Van Gogh Museum, my God, they are amazing visual experiences. Besides the money or what they're worth or the queues of, you know, Japanese people gathered around the sunflowers or something, when you actually see them, you realise, oh, actually, this is what art's about. It's about looking at the world, making a judgment about it, seeing what you can do in relationship to the world, and trying to do something really amazing. And my God, Van Gogh, those paintings, they're, you know, they're not, they're, I mean, I quite like Damien Hirst's Spring. In a way, it's a kind of homage to Van Gogh in a way, but Van Gogh's paintings, they are in a completely different world. And it's,
That's what happened to me when I first saw an Andy Warhol. I was like, oh my God, that's amazing. When you actually see it for real in real life, and I eventually bought a book.
You know, in a way that, you know, if you can just capture a little moment of that, that's quite a powerful thing to be able to do, you know, if you're an artist.
Yeah. And then I bought a book on the philosophy of Andy Warhol. And what was quite interesting, I mean, a lot of it's very much out of date, obviously, because it was from the 1960s, his philosophy. But a lot of it was really fascinating that he had great thought processes about the world and what we were moving into and things. So and so you could kind of understand where his art, his prints were coming from more if you start getting into the mind of somebody. And I thought that's really, because we don't have that with Van Gogh and stuff. They're too long ago, don't we? But now we can actually try and maybe get into the minds of the artists as well and listen to the great thought processes they have too.
Yeah. Well, just actually my wife at the moment is making a show with a gallery called Laurent Delay Gallery. And part of the story of this is about, I mean, Jessie's from New York and she saw Andy Warhol on a number of occasions. But there was this one moment when she was walking up Madison Avenue and they really like were caught in a kind of gaze looking at each other. And Jesse was, you know, groovy kid in the 1980s, and he was Andy Warhol, and they were just staring. And so she's tried to make a piece of work which is about this kind of moment of seeing each other on Madison Avenue. It's called the New York Blackout. And so it's quite, I think you're
that's
right.
Great.
It's about charisma really in a way, isn't it, that, I think.
Definitely.
It's charisma, I think.
And some really interesting thought processes as well. Listen, Bob, thank you so much. We could talk all day and we should do this again because I absolutely love it. But follow Bob on Bob and Roberto Smith on it. Instagram's where you basically do most of your stuff, is it?
Oh, well, really? Yeah, Instagram and Twitter. The Help Art and Save Twitter. Lives thing is definitely an Instagram thing. And
so go there and
don't forget Tate Modern, the Thamesmead Codex.
Go to that because that'd be brilliant. I've got to go to that. I still haven't gone. I apologise for that, and I will do it. Definitely, if you're interested in doing art and starting like I did, get You Are an Artist, Bob and Roberta Smith, that book. It just gives you loads of great ideas. I really thoroughly enjoy it. I can't recommend it enough. It's been a bit of a life changer, that, for me and my daughter. Thank you so much for joining me today, and we'll do it again sometime, yeah?
Yeah, love to. There's loads more to discuss, but it's great. And good luck with the podcast and everything. I think it's exciting.
Thanks, Bob.